bat. Kipnis on one bounce, goes to second for one.
Yes.
Goes to third. Lindor
yes.
with the throw. Double play. Inning over.
Heads up play by Lindor. You know the hitters and who's coming up.
Lonnie with a base hit right field. Napoli can walk home. Ramirez on his way to third. Helmet flies off. He's going to be stopped there. Moya hit his cutoff man, Kinsler. Ramirez was going to try to score, but this goes back to what we were talking about. The aggressive mindset that the base runners have, they want to score on every play.
Yep.
Is that well? Deep left center field. Upton looking up. Goodbye! Home run number 19 for Carlos Santana.
And a 3-1. Swinging a ground ball third. They go down to second for one, and that's safe at second is Kinsler. They'll throw to first. Miguel's trying to sell it like it went off his foot. The umpire's not buying it. Brad Ausmus is out. I have to say, I didn't think that went off his foot. Wow. They conferred in
Miguel.
He's going to get tossed. He's furious with Mike Everett.
He's got an argument.
Absolutely furious.
That's right.
Brad Ausmus now trying to keep him away so he stays in the game.
And it was obvious with all the replays we saw, we did see the pat leg move.
And now Miguel's just been ejected by Tim Timmons.
My button's not working. That's how we're going to start our show today, Jim Cushlin. Go ahead. My button's not working. That means we're not getting the big voice intro of the extravaganza. Let me do it again. I've told you this before, and I'll tell you again. I have long, in my nearly 20 years of talk radio, I have oftentimes, many, many different times, I've said that I don't need this job. If I wanted to, I could big voice my way through a career. I could get one of those great, cushy, soft jobs that the imaging guys have. The guys who sit at home with their own home studio, which is a wonderful thing, by the way, but they sit at home at their own home studio and they read a few lines a day and then they just cash massive royalty checks. The ones who don't have to do the research, the ones who don't have to watch all the games, who chart the stats, look at all of the comments, pull the interview, grab the sound, all the stuff that Jim Cushlin and I do in our respective duties. These guys sit there and read somebody else's script. They don't have to be creative. They don't have to. Come up with their own lines. All they have to do is sit there and read it in their manly dulcet tones. And you know what? I've always said I could do that if I didn't want to be the type A personality I am, and that is run my own show, decide my own topics, and do all of my own stuff. Which I, you know, it's just it is what it is. I would be pretty happy just sitting there and being this guy. And now, the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. And by the way, I have a cold that actually kind of sucked. That was nowhere near as good as I normally do that. About once every 3 or 4 months, we'll have a glitch and we don't hear our big voice guy, and I'll go into this rant, and then I'll do my own big voice introduction. That one actually didn't sound good. I will acknowledge it. I will give myself boos rather than cheers for that. But that one was not good. But anyway, welcome indeed to the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, you just heard a lot of baseball stuff there from yesterday. You may be like, yeah, all those Indians highlights over the Tigers yesterday. Yeah, well, what about today? Ask Jim Cushlin. Maybe his button got stuck there, too. We don't have any of the highlights from today yet. Maybe by the 4 o'clock hour, Jim Cushlin?
I'm pretty certain because this is in the top of the ninth now. So this one's probably going to be over very, very soon.
So we're going to get you some play-by-play highlights of the first win of the season for the Detroit Tigers over the Cleveland Indians. Can you believe that? Sitting here in Northwest Ohio, not very far at all from Detroit, a lot of Tigers fans, Mudhens fans, just waiting for this one because Indians fans have just been rubbing noses in it for, 4 months now, essentially, or since the season started, at least three, April, May, June, and we're just into July. Anyway, the Indians 11-0 going into tonight. Today's a season finale, or not season, series finale. It was Josh Tomlin and Michael Fulmer, and obviously Josh Tomlin did not have it. Today, Indians fans are upset. Tigers fans are euphoric Although the problem for them is this is just one game in terms of the standings, and they remain in a very, very deep hole, if you will, as we steamroll toward next week's All-Star break. So, Indians took two out of three and in extending their lead in the Central, but today the Tigers struck back, and we're going to talk a lot of baseball in the 4 o'clock hour of this program. But for now, in this 3 o'clock hour, look, I know you may be tired of talking about it, but I cannot get enough. I am completely obsessed and engrossed in the Kevin Durant story. Kevin Durant is one of my favorite players in the NBA. Yes, I am from Cleveland, Ohio, and I'm a lifelong Cavaliers fan. And as such, I root for the Cavaliers. And if the Cavaliers had taken on the Thunder, had the Thunder held their 3-1 lead in the Western Conference Finals, I would have been all over Kevin Durant like a cheap suit, at least on the radio, because I want him to lose. But every other time, I want him to win. Been a favorite guy of mine since he got into the league. One of the easiest to like, classy, humble superstars that you're going to find in sports. And it makes it very, very easy to like a guy like that. Now, having said all that, he decided to go to the dark side. He put on the black hat, the black cape, whatever it is you want to call it. He's going over to play with the cocky punks in Golden State in Oakland, California that he couldn't beat. And to me, it is not all right. It wasn't all right when LeBron James left Cleveland. And it's not all right that Kevin Durant is leaving Oklahoma City. And it's especially not all right that it signals that the fact that there, we really have reached the end of the whole rise up and beat your rivals era in the NBA. That's what it does. There was a time when it was, man, those guys got us this year. Wait till next year. Coming back to get you. How long did it take for the Pistons? How long did it take for the Pistons to overcome the Celtics? How long did it take for the Bulls to overcome the Pistons? Did Isaiah say, man, this sucks. I'm going to go and play for Boston. How about you let me run the point and I'll feed you, Larry. How's that sound? No, it doesn't work that way. Rise up and beat them the next year is dead. Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook and Serge Ibaka's gone now, but Deion Waiters and Steven Adams and the entire crew, they were there. They were on the cusp of the NBA Finals and what would have been a memorable one, I believe, between the Thunder and the Cavaliers. And rather than, all right, we let that one get away, but we're back next year. I'm going to sign a 2-year with a 1-year option. I'm going to get back there with Russ. We're going to go to work, maybe even add Al Horford to improve our inside. We're going to go to work, and we're going to hold that lead next year. And who knows? We win a title. Maybe we both decide to sign long-term and stay put. But we're going to make another run at this. Instead, to just bolt and go to your rival, it doesn't sit well with me. I'm obsessed with the story, not just Kevin Durant and the Thunder, but the entire aspect of the NBA's super teams. It's bad for the sport, and we're going to talk about it. Joining us now to talk about just that, and I hope I have him on the line. I've got an issue. That sounds like an airport, so it sounds like I caught him. Jim's buttons might not be stuck again. Joey Conger writes for WelcomeToLoudCity.com, which is the Oklahoma City Thunder SB Nation website. And he is at an airport right now, and I think I hear the PA announcer calling somebody's flight. Joey, that's not yours, is it?
No, it's not. I don't take off for a couple more hours.
All right, so you got some downtime. All right, well, thanks for squeezing us in. If I may ask, where are you traveling? Is this Summer League related?
Yeah, I'm in Orlando right now, flying, back to, Tulsa, where I'm from.
Okay.
And, it seems that, Summer League, wasn't as prominent in the minds of NBA fans as it was in, previous years, especially in Oklahoma.
Yeah, well, maybe it was more prominent in previous years because we didn't have these monumental salaries taking all of the headlines away from any of the Summer League activities. With the television monies expanding, revenue expanding, salary cap expanding, and a whole bunch of guys getting richer than anybody could even imagine in this sport, not to mention a top three player in this league changing teams, I think that's probably why your Summer League isn't gaining as much traction as maybe you thought it would.
Yeah, probably had something to do with it.
Indeed. All right, let's get into the nuts and bolts of this now. We've heard everybody reacting to Kevin Durant and the seismic shift in the Western Conference as he goes to Golden State. But I haven't really heard too much other than statements made by the general manager and ownership and some of the teammates there. But be the voice of the fan for us in Oklahoma City, if you could, Joey. Tell us. And I don't know, is there a way for you to get away from that speaker? that the PA,
no,
Yeah, I don't know if you're.
No, near. I don't think so.
It's, no way to escape that sound.
Pretty much everywhere.
Gotcha. So be the voice of the Oklahoma City Thunder fan, if you could, Joey. Tell us how that went down when the news first broke in OKC that the only team Kevin Durant has ever known, has ever played for, this franchise, was up and bolting.
Well, I was in Orlando when it happened, and you know the vibe around the NBA and NBA Twitter was that he was gone, you know, the day before. I think I heard from a writer that had talked to Draymond that Durant had pretty much committed to Golden State during their meeting on Friday, and it was just a question of whether, you know, he had the stomach to actually turn his back on Oklahoma City. But you know, the vibe around Oklahoma City, you know, they're angry a lot. You know, some of them are more angry than others, kind of like Cleveland in 2010, I would say.
Yeah, except maybe a little, not quite the same. And the reason I say that is I grew up in Cleveland and I was on Cleveland radio at the time in 2010. And the difference being, of course, that was a local guy. You know, he was born and raised 35 minutes outside of Cleveland. It was his hometown team, and it felt like more of a betrayal there. But that doesn't mean it can't be a betrayal in OKC as well. Did fans feel like, you know, this guy who was, you know, didn't grow up in Oklahoma City but was drafted by that Sonics franchise that came to OKC, you know, he was one of their own. He was a, you know, a local hero, if you will. Does it feel like a betrayal for the fans out there?
It doesn't feel like a betrayal for me, but a lot of people feel that way because, you know, effectively he did grow up in Oklahoma City. You know, he always said that he was born in Washington, but Oklahoma was his home. He's been here since he was 19, and, you know, he really grew up with the city. You know, I felt like, you know, he had a choice, and, you know, he made a choice. It may not have been the best for his legacy or anything, but, you know, I understand why he did it. He didn't owe us anything. He didn't promise us anything. It's just, you know, it's still shocking because you felt like, you know, other players leave, but not Kevin.
Let's go back to what you said about him having a conversation or a texting chat or something with Draymond, and that it was known as far back as Friday, his first meeting with Golden State, or his long three-hour meeting with Golden State, that he was going to do this. Can you explain that, and especially explain it in this context? It was, I guess it would have been Saturday, maybe, that ESPN's The Undefeated, you know, one of their sub-websites, ran a piece from Mark Spears saying that it's 90% certain. Sources very close. Quote, his decision is 90% made that he is coming back to Oklahoma City. That's one of his longtime friends, as quoted in the piece. So 90% he stayed in OKC, but you're saying that it was pretty much decided on Friday that he was going to go to Golden State.
Yeah, that's just what I was told. It was a writer that had talked to Draymond and a agent from Roc Nation who represents Kevin Durant. And, you know, they pitched to him in the meeting that, you know, we might win a couple without you, and you might win with us without us, but together we're going to, you know, win everything. And then, you know, reports started coming out on Sunday that Oklahoma City might not get a second meeting. They had requested a second meeting, and they might not get it. They ended up getting it, which kind of gave some hope. But, you know, his mind is pretty much made up. Presti said that himself, that he felt like Durant was gone walking out of that meeting.
There was another story, and we're talking to Joey Conger, who is a writer with the Thunder SB Nation site called WelcomeToLoudCity.com. Joey, the other story about the press, the full court press that the Warriors put on Kevin Durant, included Steph Curry sending a text message, according to somebody who said they saw the text messages. And I just heard this on Mike and Mike this morning. But Curry told Durant in a text message that there's no ego here, that he, meaning Steph, does not care who is the scoring leader or who is the MVP or who is the face of the franchise, that if Kevin is concerned about that at all, that he might be in Curry's shadow or something of that nature, that's not the way it is. He doesn't give a rip, said the texts to Durant from Curry, who gets all of the accolades. He just wants to collect championship rings. Are you aware of any of that, and how much of a role you think that would have played?
Yeah, I saw that, and I think it played a pretty big role that Curry was like, you know, if you come here, it, you know, here's the keys, it's your team. You know, because that was kind of a, it was kind of a problem early in Miami with LeBron and Wade about whose team it really was, and they didn't really succeed until Wade stepped back and handed the keys to LeBron. And Steph basically said, you know, you don't have to worry about that here. It's your team if you come. I'm just trying to win. I know you feel the same way, and I know you want to come here, and that may be one of your concerns, but you know, you shouldn't have to worry about that.
Yeah, it's a great point, the comparison to LeBron and Wade. And there was a feeling out period there, and I think it was as much between LeBron and Spoelstra as it was LeBron and Wade, too, because LeBron was used to kind of walking all over coaches in Cleveland from Mike Brown when Mike Brown was there. And, you know, he pretty much they let LeBron do whatever he wanted. He got there and tried to do the same thing to Spoelstra, and Pat Riley had to intervene to say, he's the coach, you do what you're told. Once LeBron started to accept that this is going to have to be a team effort, and Wade stepped back, as you pointed out, it worked. Do you think there will be any of that going on in Golden State, based on how well you know Kevin Durant? I don't know if you know him personally, but covering him as closely as you have, how do you think that's going to work in Golden State? Will there be an adjustment period? Will it take 6 months? Will it take an entire season for them to figure it out together, or what's your sense there?
It might take a little bit to get used to playing with each other, but there shouldn't be any chemistry issues as far as, you know, arguing or, you know, KD trying to walk all over the coach, because, you know, they went 73-9 last year, and he's the one joining that. With LeBron in Miami, Wade was pretty much the only player. Wade and Haslam were the only players, you know, from the previous Heat team, and they weren't even that good. So the fact that, you know, he's coming into a situation that had already been successful, I don't think that there'll be anything as far as Durant trying to walk over anyone.
Yeah, and he's not that kind of guy, because he wasn't that kind of guy in Oklahoma City, right? I mean, he's not a guy who tried to dominate the huddle, tried to dominate the locker room, dominate the situation, have a bunch of, you know, followers hanging on into the clubhouse or the locker room, I should say, et cetera. That was LeBron's MO back when he was in Cleveland the first time around. So KD isn't a guy that I think I'd be worried about that either, but the part about stepping back, where you said Wade kind of had to realize, all right, he's going to be top dog, I got to step back. Do you think there will be that adjustment period in Golden State, despite what Steph Curry said about not needing to be the man there? Will there be chemistry issues?
There might be, you know, for the first couple of months on the court, but I think that by the All-Star break, they should have theirs worked out. And, you know, they kind of run a motion offense, and that's what Durant wanted in Oklahoma City. And, you know, with Curry as opposed to Westbrook, he should be able to have a better time with that.
Yeah, and I would agree, except for the, I mean, if what Curry said is true, I certainly understand that. You know, if he doesn't really care about scoring 31 points a game and being the MVP and all that stuff, okay, because I kind of feel like Kevin might. And again, that's not an insult. You've covered him, so maybe you tell me what kind of a guy he is and how much he values his role as top dog. For example, just explain this to us. One of the big issues that a lot of people had focused on in the last season or two, you know, as OKC, well, once Durant got healthy and then Westbrook got healthy, they took turns being injured, obviously. But as a duo, they are clearly, you know, along right there with Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, you know, the top scoring duo in the NBA. And there was a lot of speculation nationally that, you know, Russell Westbrook wants his own kind of, you know, Batman role. He doesn't like being the Robin to Kevin or anybody else. Great player, great teammate, but he kind of wanted to have his own thing, and Kevin wants to be the top dog as well. So is that true about the relationship there? And if it is, how does Kevin take that to Golden State? Will he want to be the guy that the offense runs through?
That was part of Golden State's pitch to Durant, actually, is that he doesn't get enough respect in Oklahoma City, and that if he came to Golden State, he'd score the same amount, but on less shots, and he'd be more efficient. You know, he'd still get his 27, 28 a game, just, you know, on less shots. And I don't really think that Durant and Westbrook had any problems playing with each other. You know, they always came out to media and said that it was both of their teams. And Durant would always refer to Russ as, the best player on the Thunder, and Russ would always refer to Durant as the team leader. So I think they had a nice little relationship like that. It's just kind of a shame that it didn't last.
Yeah, it just, you know, well, tell me this. When James Harden left, I mean, that was pretty much what it was. When, you know, they were a finals team together, that threesome. Harden obviously did not have a great NBA finals, but we know what happened. You know, he essentially didn't like being the third wheel of that you know, that machine. He wanted to kind of be the guy, and he goes to Houston, and he is the guy. And he's averaging 29 points and doing all kinds of great things, but he's not winning championships. But that's kind of, and maybe it's the Harden blueprint that led some nationally to think that's kind of what Westbrook wants too. He wants to be the guy, ball dominant, first option, not second option.
Well, they kind of had a weird dynamic all year where it was for the first 40 to 43 minutes, it would be Russ's offense. He would run pick and roll with Adams, Cantor, run the fast break, you know, and then Durant would kind of take a step back. And then, you know, crunch time, last 5 minutes, you know, give the ball to Durant and get out of the way. That would basically be their offense.
We're talking with Joey Conger, who is a writer covering the NBA's Oklahoma City Thunder for the SB Nation website, the official website for the Thunder, which is welcometolodcity.com. Bob France with you and Jim Cushlin here as well. Cush has got a question for you, Joey. Go ahead, Jim.
And obviously this is the follow-up that I'm sure you've heard 100 times, as has anybody involved with the Thunder since all this went down over the weekend. Long-term, what are we really looking at for Russell Westbrook? Sure, he's going to be given the keys to be the man, as we were kind of just discussing, but boy, I can't imagine he's going to want to hang out in Oklahoma City much longer. I mean, he's going to be a free agent this year. Essentially, all the trade rumors from now until February are going to somehow involve him. From your perch and what you may know at this point, do you see him staying through this whole season? Is he gone before training camp? Is he traded away at the deadline? What's the future really look like at this point for Russell Westbrook and OKC going forward?
You know, I don't really think that they're going to get a fair value for him unless the team that they trade him to can get a commitment long-term from Russ, because he's a free agent. And, you know, if they can't do that, then I think that they ride out this season and try to pitch Russ on staying and maybe get another superstar next summer, like Blake Griffin or something.
You know, Joey, I was really enjoying the fact that some kind of middle market teams were winning championships rather than the biggest cities, you know, Boston and Los Angeles and Chicago dominating the landscape. And, you know, San Antonio's not a big market. Cleveland, who just won it, of course, not a big market. Oakland, I count as part of the Bay Area. That's actually a huge market in terms of media and everything else. But Oklahoma City is the ultimate kind of small Midwestern market. And I feel like basketball might kind of fade into irrelevance very, very soon. Now that Durant is gone, and if indeed Russell Westbrook intends to leave next year, and I believe he will, my answer to your question, Cush, is that, you know, Kevin Durant absolutely talked to Russell and said, hey, what are your plans next year? And Russell probably made it pretty clear, I'm going to go try to find my own place. And Kevin Durant didn't want to be left holding the bag by himself there. So he's like, all right, then I'm out too. I'm going to do it now because I'm up. So, Joey, the question is, you know, if they're both gone, what's the future of the Thunder franchise? Does it fade into Minnesota-like irrelevance, or you know, it's going to take a couple of number one picks like Cleveland got to get Kyrie Irving to kind of rebuild after these guys leave?
Yeah, I think that if Russ leaves, they'll probably try to rebuild again. You know, trade Cantor. Maybe see what you can get for Adams, even though he's really young. He has a ton of trade value. Mm-hmm. You know, if you trade Russ, I would like to get that Brooklyn pick from Boston and get 2 lottery picks. You know, this is supposed to be a really good draft coming up. And to kind of piggyback on what you were saying, I don't think that Russ told Durant that he's out, because if that was the case, I feel like Durant would have signed 1 more year in Oklahoma City and then left next year, where it's kind of both of them. Like, he's not 100% taking the blame. Because now Russ can leave and no one would, you know, he wouldn't be the villain for anyone, because it's like, you know, Durant's gone, why would you stay?
Well, the only reason, and we talked about this some yesterday, and this is all speculation, obviously there's no right or wrong answer, but to me, if Durant knew that Russ was going to go, rather than wait next year and then see what opportunities presented themselves for him, the opportunity was there now to join a team that is already championship caliber, that has won and then lost in the finals this year, obviously. And next year, Golden State might not have been an opportunity for them, for him. You know, they might have closed in on other free agents and not had that cap room, et cetera, et cetera. I just feel like if Durant knew that Russ was going, he was going to go now while the getting was good and get the very best opportunity that was there, and that is to join a team that really it might be just what it looks like, him away from being a dynasty, and it certainly might be that.
Yeah, that's a good point. They might not have had the cap space next summer, even though it's going up again. I could see if Russ told him he was leaving, he's like, okay, I'll leave now.
Last thing, Joey, when Golden State visits Oklahoma City for the first time this coming NBA season, what's going to be the reception? Is it going to be boos? Is it going to be mixed? Is it going to be wild cheers of thank you, you were awesome here? What's the building going to be like?
You know, that's a really good question. If I would not boo him personally. You know, it's really, I honestly have no idea. Draymond will probably get the most boos, but I think it'll be about half and half.
So if you had to kind of put your finger on the pulse of the city, you know, of Oklahoma City fans right now, you're saying it's kind of, you know, half I get it and I understand, and half I hate you, because that's what I expect would be represented in the building if you're saying it's going to be mixed.
Yeah, about half I'm disappointed, but I'm not mad. And about half, how could you do this to me?
Gotcha. All right. Hey, Joey Conger, we appreciate the time from welcome to loudcity.com, the Oklahoma City Thunder SB Nation site. Thanks for giving us the look inside the story from the Oklahoma City vantage point. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Have a good day. There you go. There's Joey Conger sitting in an airport someplace from Orlando waiting to get back to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Nobody's going to be going to Tulsa, Oklahoma next time this year. Nobody's going to be going to Tulsa to drive then to OKC or whatever, however this whole thing is going to work, because it's going to fade. It's going to fade. It's already a small market. It's not a destination city. By the way, I lived for a cup of coffee in Oklahoma, Stillwater, actually, and then Oklahoma City for a short bit, and 20-some lifetime ago, it feels like. Anyway, it's a nice town. I really, really not liked the area a lot. It's in a little suburb north of Oklahoma City called Edmond, Oklahoma, which is just terrific. Anyway, it's a wonderful place, but it's not a destination place. It's not a place that, you know, superstars are going to be wanting to choose. And again, this is one of the problems with what the NBA has tried to do here. The NBA has tried to make money irrelevant. Everybody can spend the same amount. Everybody has the same cap space. Everybody has the same cap floor or salary floor. And essentially, since you can't make more in one place than you can in another, it's just going to be where do the players want to play, since money isn't an issue. And back, you know, before, and the way it is in the NFL, for example, if you have a franchise in a city that isn't exactly what someone would call paradise, and that again is not a knock on Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, any more than it is on Cleveland, Ohio, or Detroit, Michigan. A lot of people don't see those as destination cities, do they? There's no surf, there's no sun, there's no, LA, California, or San Diego, Miami vibe, you know. So those kinds of cities would have to do what to bring star players there? They'd have to outbid everybody else, overpay. But at least you could do it. Now, Oklahoma City can't overpay to bring in another superstar to replace Kevin Durant. They can't overpay to bring in somebody to replace Russell Westbrook, because everybody else can pay the same amount they can, unless they've already used up all of their cap space on other superstars.
Or the part where if it's a free agent on your own team, you can re-sign them for a few bucks more than if you're somebody
else.
But
that significant
doesn't help
enough.
This. Exactly. It's not significant enough, and this doesn't help in this situation where you got to go get somebody from somewhere else.
Exactly. And that's the key. Because now you're looking, you're not just talking about re-signing your own guy. Obviously, everybody knows LeBron could have signed for more with Cleveland in 2010 than he got in Miami. Kevin Durant could have signed for more in a long-term deal than he could get leaving and going to Golden State. But now it's a matter of getting other people to come there. And you're not going to be able to sign them for more than they could get on their existing teams. And that makes this very, very difficult for a franchise like Oklahoma City to stay, remain, or rebuild to being viable. Viability being the real question here. There are just some markets that are going to be in a very, very deep disadvantage because of the salary cap, the system that the NBA has built. Super teams is the goal, and I think it's bad for sports. I think it's bad for this particular sport. Unless a super team is built organically, unless you're the LA Lakers with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar already and you draft Magic Johnson and then you draft James Worthy and then you draft Byron Scott, etc. And if you're the Boston Celtics and you draft Larry Bird and then you draft Kevin McHale and you draft, actually I think they may have traded for Robert Parrish back in the day. He used to be a Warrior, but it was a trade. And that's the other thing. Trades are different. Trading? When you trade one superstar to another, because somebody wrote that on Twitter today and got me a little bit bugged. Somebody said that Isaiah, you know, for Detroit, this is all in defense of KD leaving. Detroit traded for Isaiah's buddy, Mark Aguirre, to come and play. So they wanted to build their own little super team. Yeah, but when you acquire somebody by way of trade, you are sending value back to the other team. It's not just, we're going to sign this guy as a free agent for more than anybody else, and there's no value to the team that has been, you know, that the superstar has departed. So there's if a super team is built organically, more power to you. Fire it up. Good on you. Good job. When they're built like this, and they're built while one team becomes super, it literally simultaneously makes another team, especially a formerly championship level team like Oklahoma City, it makes them irrelevant. That's bad for the sport. I don't care what Mike Golic said, and I've been listening to him argue with Greeny the last couple of mornings here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. They've been going at it, and Golic has just been so vociferous about how this is fine, this is great, the sport is in great shape. Now big guy does not understand this one. I'm sorry. He thinks this is perfectly acceptable and perfectly great for the league. It is going to destroy cities and franchises. It is going to enrich, obviously, the few franchises that collect the superstars. And it is going to be a couple of Harlem Globetrotter superstar traveling sideshows going up against 24 Washington Generals every single night out, 82 games a year.
And we're
except for the few that they play against each other and when they get to the playoffs.
Which is only going to be two because of the side effect of this, and I kind of elaborated on it when I was out at Yark and chimed in a little bit with you, Bob, yesterday, was that in many ways, I said July 5th, now it's July 6th, barring something funky or massive injuries, I'm 90% hot plus sure that we're once again for the third year in a row looking at Warriors v. Cavs in the finals.
Yeah. I mean, they'll easily be the Vegas favorites to win their respective conferences, and it takes some of the drama out. I mean, it really does.
It really does. In some ways, for some markets, the whole season from the beginning at the end of October through the end of the regular season in mid-April, all the way until you get to the end of the first three rounds of the playoffs is almost irrelevant. Almost.
Reggie Miller said this on Twitter, or I don't know if he said it on Twitter. I should take that back. I read it on Twitter because it was a critical comment from Dan Dockich, I believe. Dan Dockich, of course, former a coach and now one of the great analysts in college basketball.
From right here in Toledo, by the way.
That's right. And Dan tweeted one word, which is ridiculous. He tweeted ridiculous in response to Reggie Miller's comment as quoted by the Indianapolis Star. Reggie's comment was this: a king should never leave his kingdom. End quote. That's Reggie Miller on Kevin Durant's decision to leave. I wrote, I completely agree with Reggie. And I completely agree with Charles Barkley, with the exception of the word cheating. When Barkley said this morning on Mike and Mike that Kevin Durant is basically trying to cheat his way to a championship. I'm going to play that cut for you, and we're going to get some of your reactions to it as well. Like I said, I'm obsessed with this story. I'm obsessed with the notion of super teams being good in the NBA or in sports in general at the you know, the detriment of all of the other franchises in that sport. I think it's silly. I think it's a big mistake. I think Golic is wrong. And I think people who are correct, who are criticizing Kevin Durant in this whole thing are spot on. There's something about it. All right. As we head into this, Sports Center break, I want to give you a 4-pack of tickets. If you're interested in some tremendous Polish food and fun, the LaGrange Street Polish Festival starts on Friday. Friday the 8th, it goes through the weekend to the 10th, and I've got a 4-pack of tickets for you. In fact, I've got a pair of 4-packs of tickets for you. That means 4 for 2 different people, of course. I'm not giving you 8. Don't be greedy. Callers 10 and 11 to 866-240-1065. I'll give you 4-pack of tickets each to the LaGrange Street Polish Festival that starts on Friday and runs through the weekend, courtesy of your friends right here at ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Brent's Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, the extravaganza rolls on. Still doing some NBA talk this hour. We're going to get into some baseball now that the Tigers have won their first game of the season against the Cleveland Indians. Hard to believe that you can say that on July 6th. They've been playing since April 1 or 2 or 3 or what? Excuse me, whatever it was. But finally, they take down the division-leading Indians for the first time this season. We'll get into some baseball talk. Matt Lodi will talk to us from the Cleveland side of things at about 4:05. We're going to talk to Anthony Fenech from the Tigers side of things at about 4:35, and we want you to be a part of it all the way through. But for now, more on the Kevin Durant and NBA power struggle, if you will. And there is a struggle now because power is so concentrated in so few places. Because everybody seems to think, and this is what I'm going to play from Charles Barkley. Charles Barkley was on with Mike and Mike this morning, as he is oftentimes, and is never at a loss for words. And a lot of people are mad at Charles today. If you really follow Twitter and social media, people are mad because Charles Barkley said that Kevin Durant is trying to cheat. Literally used the word cheat, meaning cheat his way to a championship ring. And I also think that's harsh. It's the wrong word. He's not doing anything illegal. He's not doing anything that a lot of other guys haven't done, particularly in recent years, especially since LeBron James in 2010. So it's not cheating, but it is less than being, you know, I don't want to say a man, but it's less manly. It's less manly because we, I think, as American sports fans, and I'll speak for myself, and you can decide whether this speaks for you too. We love seeing Roger Federer, for example, come from down 2 sets to love at Wimbledon. Today, it's over. Federer's never going to win another one at Wimbledon. Even with Novak Djokovic out, the world number one, he can't do it. It's over. He's getting smoked today. He's down 2 sets. We love stories of guys who say, oh, yeah, bring that. Bring it. I got the next set. It's 2-1 now. How you feeling? I got the one after that. Now it's 2-2. How do you like me now? Who's the pressure on now? We love the comeback. We love that. We love the guy or the person or the team that says, you may have gotten me, but I'm not done. I'm coming back to get you. What do you think made the Cavaliers championship over the Warriors so special? The fact that they beat them? Yeah, but it's how they beat them too. They didn't just win their first championship in 52 years in the city of Cleveland, in a sweep or in a 4-1 or something like that. They won it with the greatest comeback in the history of the NBA Finals. No one had ever come back from down 3-1 before. The comeback. We love the comeback. Yeah, you got us, but we're not done. We're coming back at you. And I think that's what Chuck is trying to say when he says, don't cheat your way to your title. I think that's what Barkley says, and I can tell you that's what I'm saying. We love the guy who says, dang it, we had you down 3-1 in the Western Conference Finals, Steph, Clay, Draymond, Nutcracker. We had you. And you know what? We're going to finish it. We're going to finish it, meet you same time, same place, next June or next late May, conference finals. We're doing this again. Me, Russ, maybe we're going to bring in a little partner, a little free agent addition, maybe swap out Serge for Al Horford. We're coming at you. We like that. We couldn't finish it last time, but damn it, we're not stopping. We're coming at you now. That's what people want to see. That's what people respect. That's what we as sports fans, really kind of come to revere. When we see somebody saying, well, I didn't win, and instead of I'm coming back to get you, it's, hey, got any room over there for me? It's sure going to be a hell of a lot better to be wearing your uniform to hold that trophy than to be wearing mine and have to beat you for it. We don't respect that. I have been an enormous Kevin Durant fan, as I've said every single time we talk about the NBA on this show, since he came into the league. Deep respect for him as a player, scoring machine, humble superstar all the way around, top three player in this league. There's a time, three years ago, when he won his MVP, I said he's probably the best player in the league. Of course, it was easier to say that with LeBron in Miami when we all hated that. But I believed it. And so I've always loved him. But I lose an enormous amount of respect for him when he goes over there and says, well, I don't want to have to try to beat y'all. I'm going to have to just create some space for me over there, and we'll dominate together. I don't like that idea. Here's Barkley, part of what Barkley had to say. We got a lot more for you, too, when he was with
he
Mike and Mike.
This thing where you keep telling these guys, hey, man, if you don't win the championship, you're a bum. I don't feel like a bum. I'm pretty sure Patrick Ewing and Karl Malone and John Stockton, we think we were pretty damn good. We could have played with some of those other guys and kind of cheated our way to a championship, but I think we're going to be all right. But I think Frank had the best point. Like, we have got this thing going now where your life sucks and you're a bum if you don't win the championship. I mean, trust me, it doesn't. My life don't suck. I don't think Karl Malone or John Stockton stuff sucks. But there is this thing that it started, like, I'm not even sure when it started, to be honest with you. It started like this new generation where these guys feel so much pressure. Everybody wants to win. I'm a big Chris Paul fan. I'm sure Chris Paul wants to win a championship. And he could, when his contract is up, go join one of these super teams and get a championship. But it won't be the same as leading your team where you're the bus driver instead of the bus rider. Think about this, guys.
That's the line. That's what I'm talking about. If you're driving the bus and winning the championship versus just being a passenger on the bus that has already been driven to the brink of a title, and in fact already won one just last year, and now you're just kind of going along for the ride to win the next one, not to say you won't play a role. You will probably play a huge role. But this is already a championship bus, and you're just a passenger now. Somebody else is the driver. That's a very, very, very good point that he makes.
Isaiah Thomas, who I really admire and respect, can you imagine him leaving Detroit, going to play with the Celtics because he couldn't beat them? No, I could never imagine. But when he beat them and won the championship, it meant more.
Didn't I use that example earlier in this broadcast? And I didn't even hear this particular part of Barkley this morning. I just went with the Isaiah story because Isaiah was talking about how yesterday he would never leave and go join somebody else, but if somebody wanted to come and join him in Detroit, he'll roll out the red carpet for him. That's a great point that Barkley just made, and it echoes the one that I made.
Imagine a great Michael Jordan said, you know what, I can't beat the Pistons. I'm going to go play for the Pistons. No, he got more joy beating the Pistons, winning it. Because when you're the bus driver, Isaiah Thomas has a great saying, and I totally agree. It's a lot different. All these guys who are bus riders, I don't care what they say or what they think, but I really care about the bus drivers because on every team there's a bus driver. Most of those guys are bus riders.
That's a great, great point by Charles Barkley, and he's getting killed by a lot of people for suggesting that Kevin Durant is trying to cheat his way to a championship, but I respect the heck out of that statement. Let me get a couple people on here before the top of the hour. Mark in Toledo, you're on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Mark, go ahead, sir.
How you doing, guys?
Good. What's going on?
Good. Real quick, I come 100% agree with Barkley and yourself. I think everybody is getting mad at him because it's worded wrong. But what I got into a debate at work. What I told him is this generation of players are mentally weak. They don't want to fight for a championship with their team. They don't want to build through the draft. They want it to come easy and then go back home to wherever your hometown is so you can chill and relax and play out. If you win another one, great. If you don't, hey, I got that one with that super team that I joined because I was too mentally weak to fight with the team. Durant and Westbrook would have been one of the favorites with Oladipo next year win the championship.
Absolutely, you know? They would be. And then you're right. Their mental fortitude.
They're mentally weak. Exactly.
Yeah, they didn't, I don't know what they're looking for. They're looking for a guarantee.
Exactly.
You know, and maybe that's why KD went, because I'm probably guaranteed to get to the finals with those guys, and maybe even guaranteed to be better than the Cavs. I don't know, but I agree with you. They would have been. It would have been one.
They would have been
Western
one
Conference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Year.
I think Oladipo makes a heck of, because now they can't gang up on, because Westbrook was in foul trouble a lot of that Western Conference final, but Oladipo can take on some of that scoring load. You know, so I just think it's this generation just mentally weak. They don't want to fight. The Ewings, the Robinsons, the Jordans, the Thomases, they fought, and they wanted to beat each other. There's no competitive nature anymore.
Exactly right. Well said, my man. Thank you. I appreciate it, Mark. Let me get Kevin in Toledo again real quick as well, because we do have some baseball talk to go to after the top of the hour. Kevin, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I was calling in. I also agree with Charles Barkley. You know, I just think, you know, people forget. LeBron winning the championship this year, it solidified his career in my eyes, because that championship in Miami, you have to, those two down there, you have to realize they came together and joined together, but Dwayne Wade was just 2 years removed from being the scoring title champion in the NBA. Two years before LeBron got there. And Bosh was a 20-10 player. So when you go get these guys, yes, it's I'm not going to say it's cheating like Barkley said it was, but it almost guarantees you to at least give one. And Kevin Durant turned around and did the same thing. It's hard for me to, I'm not going to say respect these guys because, hey, they work at it. They work hard at their craft. But I can't put them in the same league as a Barkley or a Karl Malone, some guys on that level, because those championships that you win on these super teams when the rest of the NBA is pretty much crap because all the superstars are on one team, to me, it doesn't mean as much.
It's cheap. It's a cheap championship if you only have a couple of other teams that are actually on your level and the rest of them are just walkthroughs. I could not agree with you more.
And then the thing, like, you know, they bring up the Showtime Lakers with Magic. Well, most of those guys were drafted, and they signed one guy, which was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And along with
and that was years before. That was years before Magic and Worthy and the other guys got drafted, by the way.
Exactly.
You know, it's not like, that's a great point you make. My friend, I got to run, Kevin. I'm up against the heartbreak here, and I've already passed it. I apologize, but I got to get out. We'll get a top of the hour Sports Center. We'll come back. We'll try to talk some more. If you want to get in at 866-240-1065, we'll take your phone calls right after the top of the hour, and then we'll transition into a little bit of baseball, because the Tigers are finally victorious in a game against the Indians. First time all season. How about that? We'll talk to Lodi from Cleveland, Fennec from Detroit about that matchup, and more coming up in hour two of the Extravaganza.
Maven hits a long fly ball down the left field line in the corner, deep, and what did they call?
What?
Home run.
Home run.
Did it hit the foul pole?
It must have.
Because it bounced straight down, must have hit the foul pole. How about that?
Have.
Cameron Maven with number two. 3-2, runners go. The pitch, swinging a fly ball, right field. This one's deep, going back. Chisenhall over his head, up against the wall. Kins around third, he will score. Maven around third, and he will score without a throw. Two out, two run single for Cabrera off the wall in right. There's a fly ball to center off the bat of Castellanos. This one's deep, going back. Naquin, he's looking up, and that ball is gone. A home run!
Whoa.
Nick Castellanos with a three-run blast to straightaway center, and the Tigers lead it 8-2.
Well, this is what we've been talking about.
Here's a ground ball glove by Parnell. He's going to throw down to second one. Avila is having a hard time getting out of his glove, but over to first. Inning ending, game ending. Double play for the Tigers, who break through against the Indians for win number one. Tigers took the lead in the fourth and just kept adding on. Another strong start from Michael Fulmer, and a big day at the plate for Nick Castellanos with five RBIs. Our final score, the Detroit Tigers 12 and the Cleveland Indians 2.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
So lightning has struck. The stars have aligned. Everything is coming up roses for the Detroit Tigers, for they have finally beaten the Cleveland Indians in the year 2016. How about that? Ah, we can't hear you cheering when we don't have everything plugged in properly. Let's try that cheer all over again. Yes, indeed. Whoever would have thought that the first win the Tigers would get over the Cleveland Indians would be on July 6th, for goodness sakes. They have owned the Indians to the tune of 37-19 over the last 3 years coming into this one. But this one goes the Tigers' way finally. It was the one, if I told you this yesterday, or I guess it would have been on Thursday, that the or Friday, take it back, Friday, because we didn't have a show Monday. That's what it was. We talked about the pitching matchups and that the one that was the most compelling was the one that we just saw today, and that was Josh Tomlin, who had 9 wins against Michael Fulmer, who was 8-3 with a ERA around, what, 2.5, maybe a little bit less? I can't remember exactly what it was coming in. But that was probably the best pitching matchup for the Detroit Tigers of the three matchups in this series. And sure enough, that is the one that they win. So we take a look at the American League Central standings now. After this Tigers win, the Indians still with a 6.5 game lead. They're 51-33, still just a couple off of the best record in baseball. The Tigers now at 45-40. And the Royals still just kind of lumbering around. They've lost 3 straight, 5-5 in their last 10. They are 7.5 back. The White Sox 1.5 game behind that. So, Jim Cushlin, I asked, or no, I didn't ask you, I beg your pardon, a Tigers fan, a mutual acquaintance of ours, by the name of sales manager Cody Welling, asked you on Twitter yesterday, you're throwing in the towel on the Tigers. You ready to grant the AL Central to the soon-to-be champion Cleveland Indians, and you said pretty much, yeah. You still standing by that?
Yes, I am. I'm still standing by that. And the response for me specifically was, I'm almost there. And really, the logic for me is, and this is obviously, I sent all these out last night before the Tigers ended up winning today, right, which will cut it down to 6.5. It came in 7.5. Was, look, the Indians clearly have one of the best rotations in all of baseball. That's going to prop you up for a good long while. Meanwhile, the Kansas City Royals and the Tigers, because I'm not really counting the White Sox until further notice, even though they're above 500 right now.
Fair enough.
The Royals, I have to count them because of what they've done the last couple years, but opposite of the Indians, their starting rotation is just horrid. And by the way, they have bullpen issues. Wade Davis is on the DL right now, so that hurts them a lot. And the Tigers, between injuries, seeming like, even when healthy, a hole in the rotation, some pen bugs, there's still a few issues with the Detroit Tigers that's going to really kind of still force them to go on a big run. At the same time, the Indians play, from a Tiger point of view, hopefully their worst ball of the season to make up what, even after today, is still 6.5. I'm not guaranteeing the crowning of the division title, but I'm real close, even though it's only July 6th.
Yeah, I was a little surprised by that. But I do understand your reasoning and your logic. It's just that it's July 6th. If this was August 6th, could they hold through, you know, 8 weeks, all of August and all of September? Maybe so. But it's July 6th. And to me, we haven't even hit the break yet. I'm not there yet. But I thought it was an interesting chat you had going with Cody on Twitter yesterday. Cody is a diehard Tigers fan, obviously. And so I wanted to kind of use that to set the table to bring in Matt Lodi. Matt Lodi is broadcaster who works with the Associated Press out in Cleveland. And he is also the owner and manager of a website, neosportsinsiders.com. NEO for Northeast Ohio Sportsinsiders.com. As we talk a little baseball, Indian style with Matt, and then Tiger style with Anthony Fennett coming up at about 4:35 or so. So, Mr. Lodi, you heard what Cushlin just said. He's ready to say the Indians, well, almost ready, he said, to say the Indians can ride this lead of 6.5 all the way through and win this division come the 1st of October. Are you there?
I'm not there, Bob, but I'm confident. As far as, you know, covering this baseball team and seeing what I've seen through the first half of the season, actually, because we've already played more than half of the games of baseball that we'll play in the regular season. The reason why I'm not there yet, a couple of factors. Number one, I don't know if this offense, as good as they've been, averaging 5 runs a game, I got to believe, I don't know if they're as good as that for a full season. You know, I mean, I know that there have been days, even a day like today, they only scored a couple of runs against a good pitcher like Michael Fulmer. But I don't know if they're good enough to score 5 runs a game all year. I mean, that's first and foremost. Secondly, when you look at this pitching staff, yes, they're great. And yes, I think they're the best in the American League. But, you know, you never know. Somebody could get hurt. You know, Corey Kluber could go down. Carrasco, we've already seen him go down once this year. There's no guarantee that this pitching staff will stay healthy. If they stay healthy, and this offense is as good as it's been, yeah, they win this division. I think they're the best team in the division. Matter of fact, I'll go on record, I think they're the best team in the American League. I think that Texas and Baltimore, the other two division leaders, are not as good pitching-wise as the Indians are. But to just sit here and blindly at this moment, other than what you've seen, say, yeah, they're going to win the division. I'm not there just yet. I think I need to see another 30 games or so, see how this thing plays out. But certainly the Indians are in a great position, and I know that they're very, optimistic, let's put it that way. And fans are starting to finally come around on this team, 25 or so today at the ballpark, which on a noon game in July, even though kids are out of school and everything, that would be unheard of a year or 2 years ago. But fans are finally coming out. We had the sellout on the 4th of July, and I think we're going to have a sellout. If it's not a sold-out game, it'll be very close come Friday and Saturday.
Matt, are they still last in baseball in
second to last?
Second to last.
When you see the
fans starting to come around, I mean that's kind of an amazing thing when you think about it. Really, as good as they've been in either at or near the top of the division essentially since they started. It's been a tight grouping for most of the first half. For them to just start to come around. You kind of wonder, and maybe people were just so wrapped up in the Cavs and their run to the through the playoffs that took 2 months.
Well, I think that's got a lot to do with it. Yeah, and I'll give the fans a little bit of a pass on that because, first of all, I mean, the emotion, and you were part of it, and you've seen it over the years in this market. The emotion of what the Cavaliers brought to this city was unparalleled. I mean, for the things that they were able to accomplish, for the things that they were able to do. It was crazy to think that the Cavaliers would win the championship after they got down 3-1. So the fact that the Indians weren't getting the crowd doesn't necessarily bother me. And the Indians are not dumb. They know that a majority of their attendance is going to come in June, July, August, and hopefully if they're in the race, which they will be, I think, in September. So they're willing, I don't want to say willing, but they're okay, I guess, is the word I'm looking for. If fans are a little bit, trepidatious, or maybe, the attendance isn't quite as strong in the months of April and May, but the June through September crowds are the crowds that they're counting on to carry this team and to really, pack that ballpark. And as I said, you got the sellout on Monday, and I think you're going to, if you don't have the sellout on Friday, Saturday, it's going to be, as I said earlier, it's going to be very, very close because they're selling SRO tickets, and there's no reason to sell standing room tickets if the place is going to be half empty on Friday and Saturday.
We're talking to Matt Lodi, talking a little American League Central Baseball. Indians today saw their 13-game home winning streak come to an end, which is a tremendous statistic, really only paling in comparison to the 14 overall game winning streak franchise record that came to an end in Toronto over the weekend. But also the winning streak against the Tigers comes to an end at 11, which is just simply an amazing thing. Matt, to what do you attribute this season-long dominance that they have had, obviously today notwithstanding, over Detroit, a team that has literally dominated them, and I mean it hasn't been close for the last 3 years?
Well, I don't want to be a cop-out, but I don't know. The Indians' starting pitching has been tremendous against Detroit. They really have. And the two main variables.
So is their offense. That 12-2 drubbing today for Detroit will barely make a dent in what it, and Kush, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was 77-24.
Right.
Going into today's game, that's how much they'd outscored the Tigers by.
But I think, Bob, when you look at this series, it starts with pitching from the Indians' point of view and the ability to control guys like Martinez, who, of course, is hurt. Castellanos, who had a monster game today, of course, and obviously Miguel and Victor Martinez. If the Indians can control those guys in this lineup, it gives them a good chance to at least be in the game, if not win the game. And I think so pitching to me is what started this streak. The offense coming around certainly hasn't hurt. I think as far as the dominance factor, let's be honest. I mean, Detroit's had a rough season keeping guys healthy. Their pitching staff is banged up. Zimmerman's on the DL. I mean, the Indians have just caught them at the right times, too. I was somebody on Twitter today. Of course, all the negative Nancys of the Indians fan base were coming out in full force today after they were, getting their belts handed to them down 8-2 and then eventually 12-2. And I said, look, you're not going to go 18-0 against anybody. I mean, that happens once every, maybe decade. And Detroit is too good to lose 18 games of the Indians. It's not going to happen. So to me, I know I heard you in the open before I got on with you talking about this being the most interesting pitching matchup, Tomlin against Fulmer. Tomlin, has had some issues, here and there, and he gave up one of those, and he even referred to it in his post-game press conference. He gave up one of those, quote, crooked innings. And against this Tigers team that has dominated the Indians the last couple years, the one kind of buzzword that you hear from the Indians, their coaching staff, and their pitchers is, don't give up the crooked inning. And when I say crooked inning, I'm talking three runs, five runs, seven runs. And today, of course, Detroit got both. They got a 3-5 in the fourth and the fifth, and that was the ball game. So as far as why this has happened, as far as why the Indians were able to win 11 in a row, I go back, you know, to what I said earlier. The pitching, starting pitching's been amazing, and they've caught some Detroit pitchers at the right time. You know, last night, Annabelle Sanchez, the other night, you know, on Monday night, they were able to get a late home run from Mike Napoli that kind of saved them. But it wouldn't still surprise me in 18 games to see Detroit win 4 or 5. It just, you know, the Indians have gotten off to an incredibly good start against them.
Matt Lodi is our guest, talking a little baseball from the Indian side of things, and talking Tigers coming up with Anthony Fenech at about 4:35. They get their first win over the Indians of the season. And you're right, nobody's going to go 18, or I think it's 19 they actually play, don't they? They got 7 more after game 12 today. In September, but nobody's going to do that. There's no question about that. But this this run, and I want to go back to the other question that Jim Cushlin addressed a minute ago, and that you addressed. You both said you're close. You're not there to say they're going to do it, but you're very confident. I'm going to give you both something to feel very, very good about. ESPN has got a story that was actually out on the first, so whatever that was, back on last Wednesday. ESPN ran this story, can anyone catch the 6 division leaders? And they put their stats department, you know, their sabermetrics or whatever word we're using these days to discuss all of the stat geek stuff. The ESPN stats and info department crunched all of the numbers based on every factor that there possibly could be, and they came up with this. In the American League East, the leader, the Baltimore Orioles, have a 38% chance to win that division, according to ESPN and baseball, ESPN stats and info and baseball prospectus, excuse me. The West, Texas Rangers were leading. They had, as of that time, again, just, what, 6-5 days ago, a 79.9% chance of winning the division. In the National League, the Nationals in the East have an 88.9% chance, or those are their odds of winning the division. In the NL West, the Dodgers, oh, I beg your pardon, the Giants have a 62% chance of winning the division. I left two divisions out, both of them Centrals. In the National League, the Cubs have the highest in all of baseball, a 98.9% chance of winning the division. Obviously, being with their lead being what it is in that division, it makes sense. But the Indians have the second highest chance of closing this thing out, 92.8%. The Royals are second at 2.7%. The Tigers don't even register. The biggest threat still might be the Tigers, but the Royals have the second-best chance. So just to throw that out there, all of the analytics and the number crunching that these organizations do now, they're basically saying, you know, that the Indians should just roll between, you know, now and in the final 3 months of the season. They should pretty much roll into October as a division champion. What do you think of that?
Well, as we talked about earlier, I do think they are going to win this division. I mean, I'm not going back and, you know, I know those numbers.
But do you think they're going to roll it, though, Matt? Because that was my question. In other words, is somebody going to pass them up? They got a 6.5 game lead now. Is somebody going to pass them up, and then they're going to come back and have to retake that lead and win the division? Or are they going to roll this between now and then?
I think they'll go the distance. Really? I'm not going to say it's going to be easy, and I'm not going to say that, you know, nobody's going to get within, say, 3 or 4 games. But I got to believe, you know, Bob, that Kansas City is not dead yet. They've had a number of injuries. We saw them sweep the Indians a couple of weeks ago before that long win streak. Detroit is the wild card to me. And what I don't mean wild card is that they're going to win the wild card. I mean, they are the wild card team in that you don't know what's going to happen. There's part of me that thinks they may go in the mode of last year and look to maybe make some deals at the deadline. Whether it helps or hurts, I don't know. You know, I think we talked extensively last year about the Tigers before the trade deadline, and then they went out and made a number of moves. And then, of course, they actually got a little bit hot for a few minutes anyway. But, you know, to me, I think that Detroit is one of those teams where they probably feel that if they can get healthy, they can put on a little bit of a run. I just don't think they have the pitching to match up with this Indians team, especially from the standpoint of what the Indians can roll out on an everyday basis. And, you know, you were mentioning how, you know, national, you know, prognosticators and all that other stuff. All of a sudden, the national media are starting to get on this Indians bandwagon. We've seen a couple USA Today reporters we haven't seen. There's been more people at that ballpark from a media perspective than we've seen in a while. And I think people are starting to realize just how good this rotation has been and is going to be, I think, the rest of the year. And I think that's the reason they'll win this division. I just don't know if I'm ready to say they're going to, you know, dominate, you know, like the 95 Indians. I think
no,
they may
I'm not
win
even
it
calling
by six,
that.
Seven
I just
games.
Mean not to give up this lead, you know, that they can – it wouldn't be wire-to-wire, obviously. They didn't do this since April. But, I mean, you know,
no.
Since they took over first place, I don't know what date that was, Jim Cushlin, but what do you think of what, you know, the ESPN analytics guys say? 92.8% chance they're going to win this division, second only to the Cubs in the NL Central. All right, I think Cushlin may have stepped away or he's on the phone screening a call, so apologies. All right, so Matt, let's get into a couple of the other issues that I wanted to talk about with
sure.
you. First of all, the All-Star picks. Francisco Lindor is indeed headed to the Midsummer Classic, first time in his career. Obviously only his second season in the bigs. Tremendous player. He has exceeded virtually every expectation of, that anybody could have had for him.
No doubt. No doubt.
I mean, he certainly deserves it. Danny Salazar, of course, is going to be going as well. Just real quick, here's Francisco Lindor.
In Puerto Rico, you know, I think the Indians, I thank them because the opportunity they gave me 2011, when I wasn't even expecting them to call my name, just it's huge, you know. That Wahoo I wear my hat, he smiles, I smile a lot too.
He does have yeah. a very Wahoo-esque smile. Does Frankie Lindor. He's thanking the Indians for giving him this opportunity. He's going, obviously. And then, as I mentioned, Danny Salazar still leading the American League in ERA, or second, I beg your pardon, in ERA, I think it is. So he represents the best pitching rotation in the American League. Any thoughts? Did anybody get left out? Or what are your thoughts on those two guys?
Well, I mean, first of all, those two guys certainly deserve it. I think if there's anybody from the team that, you know, I mean, could be at the top of that list also, I think you got to look at Josh Tomlin, even though he got beat up today. Josh has been tremendous. I don't think there's any question that he, again, despite the bad outing today, 9-2, ERA right about there. There is an interesting dilemma here, though, a little bit, Bob, that, you know, Tomlin still may make the team because of the fact that Danny's going to pitch against CC Sabathia on Saturday, and he may not. You know, he may not be able to throw at the All-Star game because of that. So we'll have to wait and see. There was some kind of just some thoughts about that yesterday that we were talking about that up in the press box and a little bit, you know, kind of with Terry Francona after the game. So we'll have to wait and see on that. But I think Tomlin's probably the one other guy. You know, Kluber's been okay. Carrasco's been better. But, of course, he was hurt, so he would definitely not be on that list right now. And as far as the other offensive players, I mean, Lindor's been just amazing. I mean, he made two plays last night that remind you of Omar Vizquel in his prime. Really does. And the way that his awareness, too, that's the other thing I was going to mention real quick about him, just the awareness on that double play to go to third base. I mean, how many other 21-year-old players would do that? Probably not many.
Yeah, totally agree. The only other people I was going to ask about really are just, you know, the big boppers. And obviously, we see it a lot. You know, big home run total guys who don't have high
sure.
batting averages and do have a lot of strikeouts. They'll make it, but oftentimes just depending on if they're the lone bright spot for their team, you know, and everybody has to have a representative. But I just wonder if Napoli or Santana, based on the 18 and 17 home runs and good RBI totals, was if they should have been considered.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, both guys, you know, have not been, like you said, I look at the All-Star game as the best of the best. And, you know, and I don't like the fact that there's, what, four Red Sox in the starting lineup, just like last year with Kansas City getting five guys. I'm not a big advocate of that. I think it should be spread around a little bit more. But at the same time, even though Napoli and Santana, I think I tweeted it last night, late in the game, I've combined for 36 home runs, which is pretty good, considering this is an Indians team that's been pretty void of big boppers, as you mentioned that term, over the last couple of years. I still don't think either of them are good enough. I think they're right there. I really do. And I think that they've got to be proud of their efforts. And, you know, certainly a guy like Santana, who people have been wanting to trade and get rid of and move up the lineup and down the lineup. I mean, the guy's played very well. I mean, he really has. He's played good baseball.
He's just a frustrating guy. He's a frustrating
guy
because when he played his first season with the Indians after the trade coming over from the Dodgers organization, he hit like 270. And people are, wow, look at this guy. Power and that kind of average, which is only going to get better. And ever since then, it's struggled to be over 240 for any length of time. It's usually below that. So even with the high on-base percentage and the, you know, the great walk totals and everything else, it's just a frustrating thing to see a guy who's got power and he's got so many other things going for him who just can't hit what he hit when he started. It's just it is for a lot of people. But
and you certainly hope that a guy like Lindor won't follow in those footsteps. Certainly doesn't look like he's going to.
No, he sure does not.
He's been incredible. And you know what I like about how this team has managed themselves is the attitude last night in that locker room, that everybody seems very happy for each other in getting those two guys to the All-Star game, Danny Salazar as well as Francisco Lindor, two first-time guys, too, which I think is kind of cool, too, that you're going to see different guys there than you have in the past. Of course, last time when the Indians even had an All-Star was Michael Brantley, who's going to, you know, hopefully be back sooner rather than later. But I do like the fact that this organization's finally getting some credit, finally getting props for all the good things that they've been able to accomplish, at least this season. And, you know, again, winning the All-Star game, unless you reach the World Series, which the Indians have to be at least in that conversation, it really doesn't mean a whole lot. But I do think that it's cool that the Indians are going to get a couple of guys there, and hopefully those couple of guys get to play and get to have some sort of impact. And, again, if Salazar doesn't pitch or doesn't get a chance to pitch, hopefully they'll send Josh Tomlin, who I think is right up there, as part of a guy that could deserve it as well.
Last thing, and we'll let you run here because I got to get to Anthony Fennec and talk baseball from the Tigers side, the victorious Tigers for the first time in 2016 over the Indians. But you may have already answered it too, Matt, when you remembered the five Royal starters from a year ago. What do you make of the Cubs having their entire infield as the starting infield for the National League, including a shortstop whose batting average is a very non-all-star-ish 238 right now.
238,
The Cubs have had a great year, and their fans packed the park, and they're stuffing ballot boxes left and right over there.
Well, that's the guy that bothers me. You know, I can't complain about Bryant or those other guys on that roster because they've all played pretty well, but that's the one that bothers me, Bob. And, you know, I know that the All-Star game in Major League Baseball, as well as in baseball, has become nothing more than a popularity contest. And if you have a good team, you know, and you know, the bandwagons get full pretty early, you know, in April and May, which is what the Cubs were killing everybody in those 2 months, people were going to vote for him. I didn't like it. I think that the managers and the fellow players around baseball should have more of an impact on who makes it. But you know what? It's a fan-driven game. And if the only reason I really don't like it, though, is from the standpoint of, unlike in the other two sports, major sports, I should say, football and baseball, or football and basketball, there is something on the line. I mean, you know, what if the Indians do make the World Series against, say, the Cubs and have to play Game 7 in Wrigley Field as compared to Progressive Field? I mean, I just think that it's a bad vibe, it's a bad look, and I'd like to see them somehow, some way modify it to where, again, the players and managers have more of an impact on the voting than just the fans. Because, you know, again, it's a very odd thing that last year we had five Royals, and this year we have, what, five Cubs or four or five
Cubs?
Well,
seven Cubs and five in the starting infield, right. So four in the starting lineup.
And Boston, too. I mean, Boston's got, what, three in the starting lineup. And you know, again, they're not even in first place. So I don't like the look of it. I think it looks weird. I just, you know, and again, if you're Bob Costas, like a baseball purist, he's got to be, you know, just screaming livid about it. I just hope that it somehow, some way, baseball looks at the situation and says, look, we should have the managers and players just have more of an impact. That's all it comes down to. It's not that big of a thing. It's not like we're saying the fans can't vote or shouldn't vote. It's just that, you know, managers and players, those are the guys that are in the locker room with those guys every single day. I just think they should have more of an impact as far as that goes.
Fair enough. Good stuff. Hey, Matt Lodi, thanks for breaking down today's game and obviously the race as it stands. We've got you down as being on the record now. You were hesitant to go there, but you finally went there and said, yeah, they're not going to get caught between now and October. We'll bring you back on in a few weeks, and we'll see if you still stand by that. Sound good?
Yep, very good, Bob. I appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me.
You got it. There's Matt Lodi from NEOSportsInsiders.com and from the Associated Press in Cleveland. Let's take a timeout now. By the way, congratulations to Ken Savinsky of Toledo and Jordan Mackey of Fremont. They were the winners of the LaGrange Street Polish Festival contest that we ran last hour. I've got another contest to throw at you now. Remember, next week, in fact, a week from tomorrow and Friday, I will be broadcasting live from the first two rounds of the Marathon Classic at Highland Meadows in Sylvania. If you would like to attend the Classic, I've got a couple of four packs of tickets. I'll give away to the 10th and 11th callers. Once again, we'll do it that way. Callers 10 and 11, 866-240-1065, will each get a four-pack to the Marathon Classic. Tigers baseball talk coming up next. Anthony Fennec joins us from the Detroit Free Press in the aftermath, the glow of a win by the Tigers over the Indians. We'll cover that next right here on The Ticket.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
You okay there, Jim?
Yeah, I'm all right. Did I scare you more than normal this time?
It just gave me one of those inexplicable
I did.
Screaming, shouting into my ear. Hot! as if you had just touched the stove and you're six. And you wanted mom to know you just burned yourself. Ah!
I hadn't thought of it in that context, but I suppose it does sound a little
you're
like
just,
that.
People who listen to the show have probably heard us talking about it. Jim used to do that all the time, ever since we started working together about it, almost 2 years ago now. And I'm like, why are you screaming at me? The mic is hot. All you got to do is say hot, good to go. And he's just screaming like you're just fired up and ready to go. Hot!
And my excuse the whole time is, well, that way you know. I know that you know.
You do, but you scare me. You scare me. You make me rip my headphones off. Or I think maybe you literally just got burned. You in there firing up a Salem or something, and you let the match get too far down to your fingertips. Hot! That's the only thing I can think of.
And for the record, no, that did not happen on 4th of July either. Just so we know, I have all my digits.
Oh, that's good news. Oh, my goodness gracious. Bad news, by the way. That is good news. Bad news is that our friend Anthony Fennec is behind. And you know why? I get it, too. Jim, obviously, I went to you for a comment a few minutes ago with Lodi. And I figured you were on the phone, and you were. You were answering the call from Anthony Fennec of the Free Press, who's supposed to join us now to talk about the Tigers. And Anthony informs you that he is behind on his writing for, you know, tomorrow's paper, his stories about this game. And he asked if he can come on tomorrow instead. And we said, of course, sure, no problem, do your job. The Free Press pays you. We don't. We just take advantage of his good nature and visit and talk with him about sports and about the Tigers in particular. I guess I understand why he's behind. He has not had to write a story quite like this one all season.
That's true.
He's not used to this. Like, what do I look at the number. The number next to the D is bigger than the number next to the C. That means Detroit beat Cleveland, and I haven't written one of those yet. I don't know what to do. I think he's struggling. I think Fennec is right now just staring at the keyboard and going, I don't know what to write. We just don't do that sort of thing. I'm still having a little bit of fun with our friends who are the Tigers faithful, obviously, because when the shoe was on the other foot, obviously it's painful to continue to get kicked by it the way the Indians had for the last 3 years by the Tigers. So now that the Indians are doing the kicking just a little bit, it's kind of fun to live it up a little bit.
Just a couple of really interesting
stories I just posted on Twitter. And on Sports Radio 106.5's Twitter feed, too, this might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but there's a piece on 538, which is a website that's more statistically oriented, kind of an analytics type of a website that is featured prominently on ESPN. The Cleveland Indians are dominating like it's the 90s again. What? Yeah. Forget about just this whole, hey, they've beaten the Tigers 10 straight or 11 straight times, and now it's 11-1 on the season. They're actually doing some things statistically that equate to the run that they had in the mid to late 1990s, when the dynasty of Albert Bell and Manny Ramirez and Jim Thome and Kenny Lofton and Charles Nagy and blah, 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 blah. Who else? Travis Fryman, Matt Williams, Omar Vizquel, Sandy Alomar. I think you know the drill. When that crew had its run of division championships and playoff appearances and two World Series appearances, both of which came up short, what they're doing right now is kind of equating to that, at least statistically speaking anyway. Those late 90s teams, according to the 538, were stocked with an outrageous number of marquee names. The 97 roster, for instance, contained 22 players who appeared on all-star teams. The 97 Indians that lost to the Marlins in the World Series. Tied for the 15th most of any team ever on one roster. With that core, they won 59% of their games from 1994 to 2001. Think about that, playing 600 baseball for 7 years. That's pretty doggone amazing. The 19th best, not overlapping, 8-season run by a franchise in history. To go with, of course, those two pennants and World Series appearances. Let's see. After the years of jinxed and otherwise interrupted rebuilding attempts, they might finally have a real successor to those beloved 90s teams on its hands this season. Through 83 games, this team has the highest ELO rating, which is their pet metric for rating a team's quality at any given time, ELO, for this stage of a season since 1998, when the Tribe was powered by Lofton, Ramirez, Thome, Vizquel, and Colon. The Indians of those late 90s were an offensive machine, scoring 1,009 runs in 99, the fifth most of any team ever posted in a single season. Remember that? I've kind of forgot about that.
Yeah, because they lost the division series after being up 2-0 on Boston. It's what got Mike Hargrove fired.
That's a crazy stat, though, that offensive machine. Think about that.
But I want to double check
fifth
because
most in any of it, I didn't realize. Maybe I forgot. Fifth most runs scored in a single season ever. Going all the way back to the history of baseball with the Yankees in their prime and all the – that's amazing. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, and that's what I actually was about to say. I want to double check because I don't know if a team has scored 1,000 runs in a season since that team. And as you mentioned, it's only happened 5 times ever.
Yeah, and by the way, in that late 90s, they also cracked the 950 barrier 2 other times. Which is pretty amazing. Anyway, I don't want to dwell on this forever, but it's just a neat piece that I was glancing at during the break that we just had. And the comparison to this year's team looks like this. This year's tribe, and I'm reading right from the 538 website, this year's tribe cuts a similar profile of all-around goodness. Their batters have the fourth most WAR of any position player core in baseball, highlighted by the emergence of 22-year-old Francisco Lindor as an outright star in his second major league season. But they can also pitch with a staff that boasts the eighth most WAR in the majors. In fact, this time around, it's the hurlers who have more star power. Corey Kluber won the Cy Young Award 2 years ago, and he might be joined in that category this year by one of his teammates, whether it be Danny Salazar or Carlos Carrasco. The sum total has been a balanced club that's finally living up to expectations and one that looks as scary as any in the American League, at least at the moment. This being Cleveland, though, the site says there's plenty that could still sidetrack the Renaissance, but that city is in an unfamiliar place after actually winning something for the first time in forever. Could they possibly be on the verge of a golden age of sports in which you put aside the Browns and just say that the Indians and the Cavaliers can recapture some of the magic of the 1990s? Remember those 90s Cavaliers, of course, were the teams of Mark Price and actually, that was late 80s. What am I saying?
Late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah,
for that.
Early
and then
90s.
They shifted to essentially everybody who was on the bench for a couple of those teams. They were in the starters in like 94 and 95.
And then it was late 90s that they got Sean Kemp as they were kind of delving into the free agent. Remember, they gave him a $100 million contract?
After they traded for him, yeah. It was at that point, it was the biggest move the Cavs had ever made, essentially.
He ate $99 million worth of donuts and was never the Rain Man again, which is
no, just not terrible. Even close. Not
Kemp
even close.
Anyway, this was supposed to be our Tiger segment, as I mentioned, with our good friend Anthony Fennec. But like I said, he is not able to join us. So just a couple of quick game notes for
the
Tigers.
And he'll join us, by the way, tomorrow. Yep. I've already straightened that out before Brad Ausmustalk's Tigers on their way north of the border where the Indians just were in Toronto to close out the first half tomorrow. Indians, of course, will stay at home, play the damn Yankees.
Indeed they are. Indeed they are, by the way. A couple of interesting matchups there, too, by the way. Trevor Bauer, who worked, if you remember, in the 19-inning game, he's the one who came in and ended up getting the win working almost, was it five? I think he worked
five. It was five full for the win, yeah.
Five full innings, yeah, and got the win in relief in that 19-inning game against the Jays. But it was, it'll be Bauer and right-hander Ivan Nova. Then Friday, that's tomorrow, Friday, Kluber and Chad Green. Saturday, Danny Salazar, and that's the big one, as you mentioned, against former Indian and former ace and former Cy Young guy himself, CC Sabathia. So
how fun is that? One of the former Indian Cy Youngs against, let's face it, a guy who may be in the running for it this year.
Absolutely.
That'll be fun.
Absolutely. Right now, he doesn't even show up in the league leaders in ERA because he doesn't have enough innings pitched because of the injury. He was on the DL for a little over a month. But while he has pitched, he has been, without question, in my mind, even more dominant than Salazar, who is going to be in the All-Star game and who could be, if he wasn't pitching on Friday, in line or Saturday, in line to possibly start Tuesday's All-Star game.
That's true, yeah. If he's going to play pitch for the Indians on Saturday, he probably won't start. That'll be the one thing that keeps him. Although I got to say, at least he's not starting on Sunday because then he wouldn't be able to play in the game at all. I hate that.
So he probably won't get the start. I don't know. I mean, I'm looking at the guys, and I'm getting off track here, but it'll probably be Chris Sale would be my guess. Anyway, Carrasco and Masahiro Tanaka is the Sunday matchup. So that is a four-gamer right there that is coming up for the Indians. And as I mentioned, I wanted to get to just a few Tigers game notes here before the top of the hour. The bombs. They were launching bombs. Miguel Cabrera, Nick Castellano, Stephen Moya. They were all had big games. Castellanos was 3 for 5 with 5 runs driven in. Cameron Maben launched one. Miguel Cabrera had a big hit. It won the homer, but he had a big hit that drove in a couple that expanded. I think it was 3-2 at that point to make it 5-2.
Yeah, Indians actually had a 2-0 lead in that game after 3.
Yep, yes, they did. Josh Tomlin got banged around a little bit. And, you know, this is the thing. This is the danger that I always talk about with the Detroit Tigers. They have an offense and they have a lineup. They have a batting order. And even when some of them are injured with J.D. Martinez being out, they are just as dangerous, really, as any order in the Central, possibly in the AL. They can explode on even a great pitcher. Well, a good pitcher having a great year is a better way, I think, to describe Josh Tomlin. He's a good pitcher, very good pitcher, not a great one, but he's having a great year. They can explode on a guy like that in a moment's notice, and that's exactly what they did today. Let me just kind of run down a couple of the other numbers for you there. Kinsler was 3-for-4, didn't drive any in, but he scored 3. Maben, as we mentioned, 2-for-4 with 2 driven in and the bomb. He has 24 RBIs now. It was his second home run. Let's see. Miggy was 1-for-3, but with 2 driven in, as I mentioned, 2 big runs because it really started to expand the lead, 3-2 to 5-2. Let's see. And he's now back up to 298. Then we have Victor was 1-for-4 with a couple runs scored. Castellanos was the big bat today, 3-for-5, as mentioned, with 5 runs driven in as well, and his 5th home run. And then Moya, 1-for-4 with 2 driven in, his home run, his second home run as well. So that offense banged out 12 hits, 12 runs, just a tremendous day at the plate, obviously, against a guy who had been kind of on cruise control really all season. Josh Tomlin was 9-2, and he saw his ERA rise to 3.51 today with 4 2/3 innings of work, giving up 8 runs total, 5 of those earned. He struck out 4 and walked 1. So just, you know, it's one of those days at the ball yard. Kershaw, what's frustrating, I know for a lot of people, because I was just reading Twitter and following the game before we came on the air, you know, Josh Tomlin is probably fans, plural, least favorite of the 5 starters. He's not a flamethrower, as we know. He's not a... He doesn't have the 96 or 7-mile-an-hour fastball that Bauer does, along with 4 or 5 other pitches. He doesn't have the 98-mile-an-hour heat that Carrasco and Salazar do, and even Kluber, for that matter, and let alone with the resume of a Cy Young. I'm a smart pitcher. I'm a crafty pitcher. I hit my spots pitcher, and that's the kind of guy that you know full well that if he's not hitting his spots, he's like, going to get lit up.
Like today.
And fans jumped on him on Twitter today, and people are like, ah, the real Tomlin returns. Oh, now this is now the game has officially been Tomlinized, and this is what Tomlin does. They're just not a big fan. A lot of people just really kind of write him off because he's not a flamethrower. But the bottom line is, you know, this is what the Indians have done to themselves. They have pitched so well for so long during this run, not just the 14-game winning streak, but during this run since they took over first place in the Central, at the very least. They have pitched so well for so long, they get one bad start, and fans are like, what's this disaster? What's this guy? Why is he out there? How come we didn't get 7 innings of 3-hit ball out of our starter today, like we do almost every other day? That's what they've done. They've become so good so quickly, and so consistently, that if they have one single bad start, the fans are going ballistic on them, and that's bothersome to me. People got to realize this is baseball, and those kinds of things are going to happen.
Not just that, but I somehow get the feeling it's just Tomlin specifically. Were they on Corey Kluber when the Blue Jays mashed him up for 8 runs over the weekend? Something tells me no.
No, they weren't. Although people get a little bit worried, though, because ever since his Cy Young year, he's had, you know, some games like that,
yeah.
And obviously not great numbers since then, or as great anyway. But it's a rough thing when you've set the bar so high that
yep.
you expect great starts each and every night out, and if you don't get one, it's suddenly like, oh, what's wrong with this guy? He's a bum. No, he's not a bum. He's 9-3 for crying out loud, and he's got an ERA of 3.51. Live with it. Deal with it. It is still exceptional for you. It's one day. You know, if he
yeah.
starts putting 4 or 5 starts in a row like that, then we'll start talking about it.
Meanwhile, by the way, real quick, Bob, from the Tigers' point of view, this was kind of exactly the kind of a win specifically over the Indians that needed. Because quite frankly, well, last night when I was watching this, basically the same type of game, only reversed the score. After the 4th inning and the Indians had, I think it was 2-0, then 4-0, the Tigers, just facial expressions and body language, they looked like they quit. In a way. So from a Tigers point of view, this is exactly the kind of win you needed against this team, who, by the way, these two teams will not face off against each other until sometime in September. But it gets those negative vibes out of your head. Because last night, I got to be honest, I saw a Tigers team that was partially quitting, and it looked like the Indians were in their heads.
Yeah.
So a game like today, where everybody in the lineup produces, basically, where Fulmer, one of their young pitchers, has another decent, he's having an outstanding year. That's exactly the kind of win, if you're a Tigers fan, that you needed specifically against the Indians, because it'll put you in a better state mentally, if nothing else.
I completely agree. And you know, it's the kind of thing that finally, not that it should matter to the Indians, because they couldn't have expected to go 19-0 against these guys, but it also kind of says, all right, that run of dominance is over, and each time we play them now, it's going to be a dogfight, because and they're going to continue to be chasing us in this division, and if we slip even a little bit, they may pounce, and that's something that is a mental advantage for the Tigers. By the way, one other Tigers note, Miguel Cabrera announced very, very quickly he is not going to participate in the Home Run Derby. He said he needs rest for the second half, battling knee and back soreness and other things, so he said absolutely not, no Derby. That comment made, I guess it was earlier today, maybe before today's game, just picked that up today. So there you go. That's it for the extravaganza today. Great basketball discussion in hour number one. Really enjoyable baseball discussion here in hour number two. Tomorrow we'll do probably a lot more of both and see where else the sports world takes us. But we're back tomorrow at 3 for the next extravaganza. For now, it's Mike Miller. Drive Time is coming your way. Stay where you are on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.